Welcome to Blog Talk Radio. This is Westchester on the Level with your host, Hezzy Eris.
Good morning, everybody. Well, today is Tuesday. It's the 14th of January, 10 o'clock on the Eastern Seaboard. It's just going to be you and I. So I'm going to be reading the news, the latest news that's out there. And then between takes, between one story and the next, I'll be rechecking our studio switchboard just to see in case anyone is giving us a call. So let's start off with one of the most compelling issues. Evidently, Iran has made an arrest in the downing of Ukrainian jet as Rouhani vows to punish those involved. Well, Iran's judiciary said today that arrests have been made over the accidental shootdown of a Ukrainian passenger plane that killed all 176 people on board just after takeoff from Tehran. Well, the announcement came shortly after Iran's president called for a special court to be set up to probe the downing last week of the plane by Iranian forces. Judiciary spokesman Gholam Hossein Esmaili was actually quoted by Iranian state media saying that, quote, extensive investigations have taken place and some individuals are arrested. He did not say how many individuals have been detained or named them. Well, Iran, which initially dismissed allegations that a missile had brought down the jetliner, acknowledged 3 days after Wednesday's downing and in the face of mounting evidence that its Revolutionary Guard had shot down the Ukrainian plane by mistake. Well, the judiciary should form a special court with a ranking judge and dozens of experts, President Hassan Rouhani said in a speech televised in Iran today. This is not an ordinary case. The entire world will be watching this court. Rouhani called the incident, quote, a painful and unforgivable, end quote, mistake, and promised that his administration would pursue the case, quote, by all means, end quote. The responsibility falls on more than just one person, he said, adding that those found culpable, quote, should be punished, end quote. And continuing, there are others too, and I want that this issue is expressed honestly, he said, without elaborating. Rouhani called the government's admission that Iranian forces shot down the plane the, quote, first good step, end quote. The plane en route to the Ukrainian capital of Kiev was carrying 167 passengers and 9 crew members from several countries, including 82 Iranians, 57 Canadians, including many Iranians with dual citizenship, and 11 Ukrainians, according to officials. There were several children among the passengers, including an infant. Iran shot down the plane when it was bracing for possible U.S. retaliation for a ballistic missile attack on 2 military bases housing U.S. troops in Iraq. No one was hurt in that attack, which was carried out to avenge the stunning killing of Revolutionary Guard General Qasem Soleimani in an American airstrike in Baghdad. The shootdown and the lack of transparency around it has reignited anger in Iran at the country's leadership, with protesters taking to the streets in past days. Online videos appear to show security forces firing live ammunition and tear gas to disperse protests in the street. So, whew, heavy duty stuff, huh? Well, on top of that, let's go and see what's going on in Libya. Evidently, Libya's present leader, Haftar, has left Moscow without signing a ceasefire deal. Well, Libya's eastern strongman, General Khalifa Haftar, has left Moscow without signing a ceasefire agreement to end 9 months of fighting in the country, the Russian Foreign Ministry confirmed to Agence France-Presse today. Haftar on Monday evening asked for until Tuesday morning to look over the agreement already signed by the head of UN-recognized government Fayez al-Sarraj, but left the Russian capital without signing. Russia's foreign ministry spokeswoman Maria Zakharova had said, Now, the two delegations from Libya on Monday spent 7 hours in an attempt to sign a deal outlining the terms of a permanent truce in Libya following a ceasefire that took effect over the weekend. Well, mediated by Russian and Turkish foreign and defense ministers, the talks did not include the warring sides meeting face-to-face, but Moscow said there was, quote, progress, end quote, and that Haftar viewed the ceasefire document positively, quote, end quote. Now, Russian state media, citing Libyan sources, later said, however, that his plane departed Russia after a failure to reach a permanent agreement, leaving the fragile truce in uncertainty. Well, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said on Tuesday he would, quote, teach a lesson, end quote, to Libyan strongman Khalifa Haftar if he resumes fighting after abandoning ceasefire talks in Moscow. Quote, we will not hesitate to teach a deserved lesson to the putschist, meaning the guy who attempts to coup, Haftar, if he continues his attack on the country's legitimate administration. And our brothers in Libya, Erdogan told the meeting of his party in Ankara in a televised speech. Erdogan said the issue would now be discussed at talks in Berlin on Sunday, attended by European, North African, and Middle Eastern countries, as well as the United Nations, European Union, African Union, and Arab League. The putschist Haftar did not sign the ceasefire. He first said yes, but later, unfortunately, he left Moscow. He fled Moscow, Erdogan said. Despite this, we find the talks in Moscow were positive as they showed the true face of the putschist Haftar to the international community. Western powers are keen to stabilize Libya, home to Africa's largest proven crude reserves, following years of turbulence since a 2011 NATO-backed uprising killed longtime dictator Muammar Gaddafi. So, my goodness, these are some of the concerns. Well, let me quickly take a look at our studio screen. We're fine there, no calls in. So let's move on to what's happening around the world. Well, we move on to Ireland. Evidently, Ireland's Prime Minister, Varadkar, has called early elections for February 8th. Ireland will go to the polls in an early general election on February 8th, Prime Minister Leo Varadkar said on Tuesday, hoping to capitalize on a Brexit deal and talks in Northern Ireland. The election will be held on Saturday, February 8th, he said in a speech in Dublin, adding that he would ask President Michael Higgins to dissolve Parliament. Varadkar later posted a video on Twitter outlining what he sees as his achievement in power. Quote, we've made good progress since I've become prime minister, he said, but I don't know if it's enough, and we want to do much more. The election is likely to revolve around the issues of health and housing. Ireland is struggling with a housing crisis and has faced hospital overcrowding. So those are the big issues there, and I guess we'll have to see what happens with the government in, 3 weeks' time? Then let's move on to another crisis point. Evidently, Lebanese demonstrators have taken to the streets in order to show their ongoing anger with their leaders. Lebanese protesters blocked several roads around the capital of Beirut and in other areas of the country on Tuesday in renewed rallies against the ruling elite they say have failed to address the economy's downward spiral. Protesters burned tires and blocked three main highways leading to the capital from the south, east, and north, bringing traffic to a standstill. School and university students took part in some of the protests, and hundreds marched down main highways, raising Lebanese flags and blasting rallying songs through loudspeakers. In downtown Beirut, dozens rallied outside the central bank, chanting against the governor and his financial policies. Security forces separated the protesters from the bank's entrance. In the northern city of Tripoli and in Akkar province, protesters sat in the streets and blocked several roads with burning tires or bricks. In the southern city of Sidon, dozens of protesters marched down the streets, rallying outside banks and government offices. Lebanon is facing its worst economic crisis in decades, with the local currency plummeting before the dollar, losing over 60% of its value over the last weeks, while sources of foreign currency have dried up. Meanwhile, banks have imposed informal capital controls, limiting withdrawal of dollars and foreign transfers in the country, which rely heavily on imports of basic goods. Panic has set in among residents who fear their deposits are in danger. Nationwide protests for 3 months have failed to pressure politicians to form a new government to institute drastic reforms. While the protesters returned to the streets after several weeks of relative calm, following the designation of Hassan Diab as prime minister in mid-December, but he has so far failed to form an emergency government amid political divisions and jockeying for power. Prime Minister Saad Hariri resigned in late October. I would like to know why they, meaning the politicians, are still keeping their seats, said Eli Zahid, a protester said. Well, lately, protesters had focused their ire on banks, rallying at the premises of or outside banks and demanding access to their deposits. Dozens have also taunted politicians who showed up in shopping malls or restaurants, sometimes chasing them out of public places and decrying their failure to address the economic crisis. Well, nationwide protests began in mid-October in Lebanon, denouncing years of government mismanagement and corruption, demanding the political elite to step down. Unbelievable. Well, bear with me a moment. I'm going to go back to our studio screen, which looks fine. And then we're going to move on to other things that are taking place. Bear with me a second. This is very interesting because the United States has dropped China's currency manipulator label ahead of a trade deal signing. Evidently, there is an agreement, but we're not sure exactly what it is yet. It has yet to be announced. United States Treasury Department yesterday dropped its designation of China as a currency manipulator days before top officials of the world's two largest economies were due to sign a preliminary trade agreement to ease an 18-month-old tariff. A tariff war, rather, and the widely expected decision came in a long-delayed semi-annual currency report, reversing an unexpected move by Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin last August at the height of the U.S.-China trade tensions. Mnuchin had accused China of deliberately holding down the value of its yuan currency to create an unfair trade advantage just hours after President Donald Trump, angered at the lack of progress in trade negotiations, had also accused China of manipulating its currency. The Treasury Department had not labeled China a currency manipulator since 1994, and Beijing had recently met just one of the department's three criteria needed for such a designation, a large bilateral trade surplus with the United States. In its latest currency report, the Treasury said that as part of the Phase One trade deal, China had made, quote, enforceable commitments to refrain from competitive devaluation, end quote, and agreed to publish relevant data on exchange rates and external balances. Chinese Vice President Liu He arrived in Washington on Monday for a White House ceremony to sign the trade deal with Trump. People familiar with the negotiations said that although the manipulated designation had no real consequences for Beijing, its removal was an important symbol of goodwill for Chinese officials. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer on Monday told Fox News that the translation of the U.S.-China trade agreement was almost completed and the text of the deal would be made public on Wednesday, that's tomorrow, before the ceremony. The currency report said the Chinese yuan, also known as the renminbi, had depreciated as far as 7.18% U.S. To the dollar in early September, but had rebounded in October and was currently trading at about 6.93 per dollar. In this context, Treasury has determined that China should no longer be designated as a currency manipulator at this time, the report said. It said, however, that China should take decisive steps to avoid a persistently weak currency and allow greater market openness, to strengthen its long-term growth prospects. There was no immediate reaction from Beijing. In August, China's central bank denied it had intervened to weaken the yuan and said that Washington's designation of China as a currency manipulator seriously harmed international rules. Mark Sobel, a former senior Treasury official and advisor to the London-based OMFIF, an economy policy think tank, said that China, quote, was errantly designated at a moment of presidential peak, end quote. It should never have happened in the first place, he said. China manages but does not manipulate its currency. So Bell said that China's current account surplus was small as a share of gross domestic product, and it had not intervened in currency markets for years. The August move came at a time when the yuan had fallen against the dollar because of market apprehension over Trump's, quote, ratcheting up a trade up of trade tariffs, he said. Well, the Treasury report also cited continued concerns about the currency practices of eight other countries: Germany, Ireland, Italy, Japan, Malaysia, Singapore, South Korea, and Vietnam, and added a fifth, Switzerland, to its list. It raised particular concerns about Germany, the world's fourth largest economy, which it said continued to have the world's largest current account surplus and was slipping into recession. It said the German government had a responsibility to undertake tax cuts and boost domestic investment. The Treasury report said the continued strength of the U.S. dollar was, quote, concerning, end quote, given the International Monetary Fund's judgment that the dollar was overvalued on a real effective basis. It said that the real dollar remains about 8% above its 20-year average, noting that sustained dollar strength would likely exacerbate persistent trade and current account imbalances for the United States. U.S. Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, a fierce critic of China's currency and trade practices, blasted the Trump administration for its decision to, quote, back down, end quote, from labeling China a currency manipulator. Quote, China is a currency manipulator. That is a fact, Schumer said in a statement. Unfortunately, he continued, President Trump would rather cave to President Xi Jinping than stay tough on China, end quote. The yuan reached five-month highs earlier on Monday, ahead of the expected signing of the trade deal, which will take place on Wednesday, the day after the Democratic Party presidential hopefuls. So we'll have to see where all that goes. Again, let's take a quick look at our studio screen. We seem to be fine, so no problem. We'll continue onward. Now, this is very interesting with regard to Nissan and Renault. Evidently, Nissan has denied rumors of a plan to divorce itself from Renault. Well, it seems that Japanese auto giant Nissan is, quote, in no way, end quote, planning to end its partnership with Renault, the Japanese automaker insisted today after a report suggested a divorce was possible in the wake of the Carlos Ghosn scandal. Well, Britain's Financial Times, citing several people with knowledge of the matter, end quote, said on Monday that said senior executives at the scandal-hit firm were speeding up work on secret plans for a potential parting of the ways with France's Renault. But in a statement, Nissan firmly denied the claims. Nissan is in no way considering dissolving the alliance, the statement said. The alliance is the source of Nissan's competitiveness, the firm said, adding that it would look to continue delivering, quote, win-win results for all member companies. While the partnership, which also includes Japan's Mitsubishi Motors, has been troubled since the shock arrest of its former chief, Hosen, on charges of financial misconduct. Now, Hosen, who last month jumped bail in Japan and fled to Lebanon, claimed the charges against him were cooked up by disgruntled Nissan executives hoping to block his plans to more closely integrate the automaker with Renault. In a news conference in Lebanon, he claimed the alliance was now on the rocks and directionless. Well, the alliance's new chief, Jean-Dominique Senaud, earlier hit back at the reports of a planned split, telling Belgian daily L'Echo claims had, quote, no connection to the current situation of the alliance, end quote. Now, the Renault-Nissan alliance is not dead. Soon we will show you why, he said in an interview published on Tuesday. I ask myself, where does this sort of information come from? I am not sure it comes from a place of goodwill, Senaud had said. Now, Nissan fell nearly 3% on Tuesday afternoon. The 20-year partnership between Nissan and Renault, whose alliance is based on cross-shareholdings without a joint structure, has been badly shaken by the Hosen scandal. But Senaud said the alliance was, quote, nowhere near, end quote, the point of collapse, and insisted its leaders were busy recreating its original spirit and planning future investments. A source close to Nissan told Agence France-Presse that the leaks probably came from a few disgruntled souls, quote, end quote, including the company who wanted, quote, to vent their frustration, end quote, adding that rebuilding trust between the two firms, quote, will take time, end quote. I tell you, these spats, it's like family spats all the time. Unbelievable. Well, let's see what's going on in Egypt, because it affects us. Evidently, an American citizen convicted in a mass trial dies in an Egyptian jail. Well, the United States on Monday confirmed the death of Egyptian-American Mustafa Kassem in a prison in Egypt, where he had been in custody since 2013 and vowed to continue raising concerns over Cairo's human rights record. Well, Egypt's state prosecutor said Kassem died in a Cairo hospital on Monday, saying in a statement an autopsy had been ordered to determine the cause of death. Prosecutor said Kassem had been transferred on Sunday from a jail hospital to the Cairo University Hospital. Kassem, who had been on a liquid-only hunger strike to protest the conviction, stopped taking liquids last Thursday. Rights group Pre-Trial Rights International said in a statement. Now, the group, which said it was representing Kassem and his family, also said that Kassem died on Monday in a hospital. I'm deeply saddened to learn about the death of a U.S. citizen, Mustafa Kassem, who'd been imprisoned in Egypt, the U.S. Assistant Secretary for Near Eastern Affairs, David Schenker, told a State Department briefing. Well, his death in custody was needless, tragic, and unavoidable, Schenker said. Quote, I will continue to raise our serious concerns over human rights in Americans detained in Egypt at every opportunity, he said. Now, Kassem was sentenced to prison in September of 2018 with dozens of others over a 2013 sit-in that ended with security forces killing hundreds of protesters. Now, the sentences, which included jail terms for more than 600 others, concluded a mass trial of people accused of murder and inciting violence during the pro-Muslim Brotherhood protest at Rabah Adawiya Square in Cairo. Washington is Cairo's closest Western ally and one of its top aid donors. Rights activists say that President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has overseen an unprecedented crackdown on freedoms in Egypt since he took power in 2014. Sisi and his backers say the measures are needed to keep Egypt stable and to counter threats from Islamist militants. Rabah Square was the single most deadly incident in unrest that followed the 2011 popular uprising that toppled Egypt's longtime leader, Hosni Mubarak. So these are some of the concerns of the day. Now let's go back to our studio screen. We seem to be fine. Let's find out what's going on with the Yonkers Tribune, and we'll be back.
The Yonkers Tribune, named Home of the Acid-Tongued Bloggers by the New York Times, is a multifaceted news organization dedicated to keeping the citizens of Yonkers and Westchester informed via the internet and radio. Hezzy Aris is the tireless publisher, editor, and radio host of the Yonkers Tribune. He is a balding, bearded gnome, equipped with a digital camera and a steno pad at all times. Hezzy is frequently spotted in local meetings, translating the events into a Baroque prose style with an infusion of well-mannered outrage. The Yonkers Tribune attracts an informed, well-educated, affluent audience who hungers to know more about politics in all its permutations and nuances. Politics, says Hezzy, is our forte. Advertising inquiries are always welcome. Please call Hezzy Aris at 914-562-0834 or send an email to ehezi@hush.com.
Welcome back. If you want to reach out to the Yonkers Tribune, they've got a new number, which you may find very, very convenient. The number is for the voicemail, for text, for cell, and for the office. All the same number, 347-415-4326. So again, the number is good for the office, for the cell, for the text, and for the voicemail. It's the number 347-415-4326. So we're going to go back to our studio screen, and we're going to look at something that's really unique, something new. Spike Lee will be the first black head of the Cannes Film Festival. Well, American director Spike Lee was named president of this year's Cannes Film Festival jury on Tuesday, becoming the first black head of the panel. The maker of Malcolm X and Do the Right Thing is the first person of black African descent to preside at the world's biggest film festival, which is held in May on the French Riviera. Lee, who's 62, said he was shocked, happy, surprised, and proud all at the same time, and quote, to make history. The Cannes veteran has premiered 7 of his films at the festival, with his debut film, She's Gotta Have It, causing a sensation in 1986 when it won the Youth Prize of Directors Fortnight. Well, his appointment comes as activists criticized the Oscars on Monday for ignoring actors and directors of color, with no nominations for the acclaimed performances of Awkwafina in the Chinese-American drama The Farewell, and Lupita Nyong'o in the horror film Us. Lee, who showed his last film, Black Klansman, at Cannes 2 years ago, said, quote, my biggest blessings have happened out of nowhere, end quote. I'm honored to be the first person of the African diaspora, meaning in the United States, to be named president of the Cannes jury and of a main film festival. Lee will also be awarded an award called the Palme d'Or, the festival's top award for lifetime achievement. In a written statement from his home in the People's Republic of Brooklyn, New York, Lee said Cannes had changed his life. Quote, to me, the Cannes Film Festival, besides being the most important film festival in the world, no disrespect to anybody, has had a great impact on my film career. Quote, you could easily say Cannes changed the trajectory of who I became in world cinema, he added. Lee also thanked the great people of France who have supported my film career throughout 4 decades. I will always treasure this special relationship. Only one Asian, the Hong Kong auteur Wong Kar-wai, has ever led the Cannes jury in its 73-year history. French actress Isabelle Adjani, whose father was Algerian, became the first person of African descent to lead the jury in 1997. The world's top film festivals have faced fierce criticism for their lack of diversity in recent years. Cannes and its rival Venice have faced growing scrutiny, particularly for the lack of female directors in their main competitions, even as they have chosen gender-balanced juries. More than 80 actresses and women filmmakers, led by then jury president Cate Blanchett, staged a red carpet protest at Cannes for equality in the film industry in 2018. Lee was vocal in his support for the women at the time. Spike Lee's perspective is more valuable than ever, and quote, festival director Thierry Frémaux had said. Now, Cannes is a natural homeland and a global sounding board for those who awaken minds and question our stances and fixed ideas. Now, Lee's flamboyant personality is sure to shake things up, he added. Last year, the jury was led by Babel and The Revenant director Alejandro González Iñárritu, the first Mexican and only the second Latin American to preside over the festival. The winning film, Korean Bong Joon-ho's Parasite, has since become a runaway hit, winning the Golden Globe for Best Foreign Film and 6 Oscar nominations. Whoa. Well, things are changing evidently, or so it seems, or at least the trajectory seems appropriate. Now, let's move on to something else with regard to Iran again. Iranians are venting their anger for a third day in the wake of the plane crash. One second. I think we actually covered all of this earlier. I just thought maybe I had a separate article. To be honest with you, I don't even know if I'm coming or going at times. And let's move over to what's happening in our hemisphere, particularly with regard to Haiti. The political crisis in Haiti could lead to a president ruling single-handedly. Well, Haitian President Jovenel Moïse could be ruling by decree later this week, a scenario he said would help break the Caribbean nation's political deadlock, but which critics fear will undermine its fragile democracy. In the early hours on Monday, the president said the mandates of lower house deputies and most senators formally expired because no successors were elected in October after the troubled country failed to hold elections. Now, the power vacuum could deal a significant blow to democratic governance in the poorest country in the Americas, 3 decades since the end of the dreaded Duvalier family dictatorship. Now, Moïse, however, sees the sidelining of Haitian lawmakers as positive. Quote, the current situation is an opportunity to stop the permanent crisis, end quote, said Moïse, who has come under pressure from months-long street protests and opposition groups to resign or hold early elections. Quote, the biggest problem Haiti has is the weakness of its public institutions, Moïse told Reuters in an interview. Moïse blamed Parliament for having failed to approve the electoral law required to hold last year's elections, while his opponents accused him of trying to take control over the country's electoral law. Well, under his predecessors, Michel Martelly, the Haiti Parliament was dissolved in January 2015 when last-ditch negotiations for a deal that would have extended lawmakers' mandates failed. Martelly ruled by decree until the end of his term. Quote, without the opposition, the government seems less legitimate, said Jake Johnston, a senior research associate at the Center of Economic and Policy Research in Washington. Quote, will he make efforts to work for the whole, or will he just pursue his own agenda without checks and balances? End quote. A former banana exporter, Moïse, is nearly 3 years into his 5-year term. He won an October 2015 election that was later scrapped over fraud allegations, and in January 2017, he was declared president after a repeat election in November of 2016. Well, Moïse's political base has been weak from the start. Electoral turnout for the 2016 election was low, and one second, was low, and 10% of sheets tallying votes were thrown out because of irregularities. And in a country of 10 million people, he just got 600,000 votes. Go figure that. Quote, he won an election, but there's a question about how much of a credible and legitimate mandate that provided him, given the extremely low turnout and the lack of faith in the democratic process to begin with, Johnston had said. So, oh my God. Well, now let's just see something else. Warren evidently confirms that Sanders told her a woman could not win the White House. Well, it seems that Elizabeth Warren took the unusual step on Monday of confirming a report that fellow Democratic White House contender Bernie Sanders told her during a 2018 meeting that he did not believe a woman could win the 2020 presidential race. Warren and Sanders are fellow U.S. senators, friends, and their party's progressive standard bearers who agreed early in the nominating contest to an informal non-aggression pact. But amid escalating tensions between the two rivals and with the first nominating contest looming in early February, Warren pushed back against Sanders' denial of a CNN report detailing the meeting in which he told her he did not believe a woman could beat Republican President Donald Trump. Quote, I thought a woman could win. He disagreed. Warren, a U.S. senator from Massachusetts, said in a statement released late on Monday describing the two-hour meeting in December of 2018. In its report on the meeting, CNN cited four people with knowledge of it, including two with whom Warren spoke about it soon after, and another two who were familiar with what happened at the meeting. Now, Sanders, a U.S. senator from Vermont, told CNN it was, quote, ludicrous, end quote, that he would tell Warren a woman could not win. What I did say that night was that Donald Trump is a sexist, a racist, and a liar who would weaponize whatever he could, he added. And Sanders' campaign did not immediately respond to a request to comment on Warren's confirmation of the CNN account. I have no interest in discussing this private meeting any further because Bernie and I have far more in common than our differences in punditry, Warren had said. The tussle between the two progressive senators is the second in as many days after Politico reported on Sunday that Sanders' campaign had distributed talking points for volunteers on what to say to voters who are thinking of supporting his main rivals. Guidance suggested that volunteers argue that Warren was supported by highly educated, more affluent people who are going to show up and vote Democratic no matter what. In response, Warren, while campaigning in Iowa, said she was disappointed in Sanders' campaign and hoped he reconsidered the approach. Sanders said he had not approved the negative talking points related to his Democratic rivals. Warren and Sanders are among the six candidates who will face off on Tuesday in the seventh Democratic presidential debate and the last before the February 3 Iowa caucuses, which kick off the state nominating contests. There are 12 candidates currently vying for the party's nomination to take on Trump in November. National opinion polls show Warren in the top tier, but trailing Sanders and former Vice President Joe Biden. All right, so we'll see where all that goes, and we'll see where it lands, because who knows. One second. I wanted to just check one other thing, a few other things actually for you. This is interesting as well. Evidently, there's a fight over water, which is the future battles of the world. Ethiopian Prime Minister Ahmed has asked South Africa for help in talks on the Nile Dam construction. He won the Nobel Peace Prize for forging a deal to end a 20-year-old border dispute with neighboring Eritrea. But Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed is reaching an agreement with Egypt over its project to build a dam on the Blue Nile far more difficult. Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan began U.S.-sponsored negotiations over the Grand Ethiopian Renaissance Dam, best known as GERD, G-E-R-D, in November, and were expected to conclude them by January 15, but an agreement appears to still be far off. Yesterday, Ahmed called on South African President Cyril Ramaphosa to intervene in the long-running dispute. Ramaphosa is, quote, a good friend for both Ethiopia and Egypt, and is the upcoming president of the African Union. He can make a discussion between both parties to solve the issue peacefully because peace is the foundation of everything here in Africa, Ahmed had said on Sunday at a press conference in Pretoria, the administrative capital of South Africa. Now, Ramaphosa said he was open to the suggestion and confirmed that he had already spoken with Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi about the matter. Ethiopia began construction of the dam in 2011, immediately triggering concern that the massive project would cause water shortages in Egypt, which relies on the Nile for 90% of its water supply for the population and for agriculture. Now, the Blue Nile, which has its source in Ethiopia, converges with the White Nile in Sudan and flows north through Egypt. Tensions have dogged the African nations ever since, and Egypt has at times threatened to take military action against the project. In 2015, the three nations signed a declaration of principles which maintained that the downstream nations, meaning Egypt and Sudan, should not be negatively affected by the dam. The declaration also held that if the three nations could not come to an agreement, the issue could or would be taken up by international mediators. Well, the outcome of mediation is an open question, is complicated and contentious. Legal issues are at play, said Timothy Koldas, the non-resident fellow at the Tahrir Institute for Middle Eastern Policy in Washington, D.C. Well, the last round of negotiations between the Egyptians, Sudanese, and Ethiopian foreign ministers held in the Ethiopian capital of Addis Ababa lasted 2 days and ended on January 9, 2020 in a deadlock. One of the main sticking points is how long Ethiopia will be given to fill the 74 billion cubic meter reservoir behind the dam. Egypt worries that if the dam is filled too quickly, the water flow to its country will be reduced. And Ethiopia said last week that Egypt asked to lengthen the filling time from 12 years to 21 years, a period of time that Ethiopia said is, quote, not acceptable. Well, Egypt, for its part, denies having asked for such a long fill period. The Ministry of Foreign Affairs issued a statement last week saying the Ethiopian side was being misleading, and that Egypt was on board with filling the dam in 6 to 7 years as long as the inflow of the Nile was at an average or above average levels during the filling period. Well, Ethiopia plans to begin filling the dam in July when the rainy season begins. Egypt later said that Ethiopia's government failed to prove it would take all necessary precautions to ensure that the dam would not affect Egypt's water supply, especially in times of drought. Whether the country can come to an agreement before the January 15 deadline is unclear. Public statements from the Ethiopian and Egyptian governments are contradictory, so it is difficult to know to what degree they are just posturing and hyperbole, Caldas had said. It depends on who's telling the truth, he said. The outcome of negotiations or mediation could have a profound impact on Egypt by setting a precedent that would allow other upriver nations to launch similar projects. $4.2 billion, 6,000 megawatt dam is scheduled to begin generating much needed power for Ethiopia, with one of the largest populations and fastest growing economies on the continent. By the end of this year, and be fully operational by 2020. When completed, it will be the largest hydroelectric power plant in Africa. The talks are set to resume in January 13 in Washington, D.C. They will be hosted by the U.S. Treasury Department and will also be attended by officials from the World Bank. Very compelling story, to say the least. Well, let's look at what else is going on. Evidently, the Queen has agreed to let Harry and Meghan live a more independent life. Queen Elizabeth II agreed on Monday to grant Prince Harry and his wife Meghan their wish for a more independent life, allowing them to move part-time to Canada while remaining firmly in the House of Windsor. The British monarch said in a statement that the summit of senior royals on Monday was constructive, quote unquote, and that it had been, quote, agreed that there will be a period of transition, end quote, in which the Duke and Duchess of Sussex will spend time in Canada and the United Kingdom. The summit at the Queen's Sandringham estate in eastern England marked the first face-to-face talks with Harry since he and Meghan unveiled the controversial plan to step back from their royal roles. Quote, my family and I are entirely supportive of Harry and Meghan's desire to create a new life. As a young family, the Queen said in a statement, quote, although we would have preferred them to remain full-time working members of the royal family, we respect and understand their wish to live a more independent life as a family while remaining a valued part of my family. The meeting came after days of intense news coverage in which supporters of the royal family's feuding factions used the British media to paint conflicting pictures of who was to blame for the rift. Buckingham Palace said, quote, a range of possibilities, end quote, would be discussed, but the Queen was determined to resolve the situation within, quote, days, not weeks, end quote, Buckingham Palace stressed. However, that, quote, any decision will take time to be implemented, end quote. One of the more fraught questions that needs to be worked out is precisely what it means for a royal to be financially independent and what activities can be undertaken to make money. Other royals who have ventured into the world of commerce have found it complicated. Prince Andrew, for example, has faced heated questions about his relationship with the late convicted sex offender and financier Jeffrey Epstein. Andrew, the Queen's second son, has relinquished royal duties and patronages after being accused by a woman who says she was an Epstein trafficking victim who slept with the prince. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex also faces questions on paying for taxpayer-funded security. Home Secretary Priti Patel refused to comment, but said safety was a priority. There were signs earlier in the day that the House of Windsor had moved to unite. Princess William and Harry issued a joint statement criticizing a newspaper article on the severe strain in their relationship, calling the story offensive and potentially harmful as they embark on talks regarding the future of the British monarchy. Well, though the statement didn't name the newspaper, the Times of London had a front-page story about the crisis in which a source alleged that Harry and Meghan had been pushed away by the bullying attitude from William. The joint statement insisted that the story was false, quote unquote. For brothers who care so deeply about the issues surrounding mental health, the use of inflammatory language in this way is offensive and potentially harmful, the statement had advised or informed. So that's the issue there. Well, I see it's about 11 minutes to the hour of 11. So we're going to move back to our studio screen. One second. Let me just check. We're all fine there. And then I want to go on to some other issues. One second. Well, this is very interesting. Evidently, the French entry, Les Miserables, has been nominated for the Best Foreign Language Film Oscar. Well, months after winning the jury prize at the Cannes Film Festival, French director Lydie Lise Les Miserables will be vying for Oscar glory on February 9 when it takes on the Palme d'Or laureate Parasite in the Best Foreign Language category. Now, Lottie Lise's impressive debut feature was nominated for the 92nd Academy Awards on Monday, becoming the first French entry to get the nod since Mustang by Turkish director Deniz Gamze Ergüven back in 2016. Les Miserables will face heavyweights Parasite by South Korea's Bong Joon-ho and Pain and Glory by Spain's Pedro Almodovar, along with Corpus Christi by Poland's Jan Komasa and Honeyland by North Macedonia's Tamara Kotevska and Ljubo Stevanov. Well, both a critical success and a box office hit, Lee's film casts a spotlight on the festering issue of police violence in some of France's most deprived suburbs, blighted by poverty, unemployment, and injustice. It is inspired by the riots that swept through the poorer immigrant-rich suburbs of Paris in 2005, following the death of two teenagers who were electrocuted in a power station while running away from police in the suburb of Clichy-sous-Bois. Now, Lee has taken another incident in nearby Montfermeil, his hometown, and the setting for Victor Hugo's 19th-century classic Les Miserables as the basis for his movie, which follows the consequences of a violent police blunder in a tense and racially divided suburb, seen through the eyes of a cop who has just joined its anti-crime unit. Now, while the film draws on Lise's own experience in the Paris suburb, he once covertly filmed and published a video of police brutality in Montfermeil, leading to an unprecedented internal police investigation. The filmmaker has described it as a, quote, universal, end quote, warning cry about poverty and racism over that one that, quote, should speak to as many people as possible. Well, in other categories, Todd Phillips' supervillain origin story Joker topped the field with 11 Academy Awards nominations, while Martin Scorsese's The Irishman, Quentin Tarantino's Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Sam Mendes' 1917 all trailed close behind with 10 nods apiece. My goodness, this is going to be an unbelievable year, that's for sure. Bear with me a moment. Let's just see what else is happening around the nation. One second. All right, I think we're actually fine with the news coverage so far. Let me just quickly look. Okay, there are a few stories that we need to cover as well. Evidently, there are fears for southern Yemen as a landmark peace deal is crumbling before our eyes. It seems that a power-sharing agreement between the Yemeni government and southern separatists is effectively defunct more than 2 months after it was signed, increasing fears of renewed hostilities. The deal to resolve a tussle for control in the south, dubbed a civil war within a civil war, was hailed as a stepping stone towards ending the wider conflict in Yemen when it was struck in Riyadh last November. Last August, deadly clashes broke out between the government and the secessionist Southern Transitional Council, the STC, which seized control of the southern city of Aden. Aden had served as the internationally recognized government base after it was pushed out of the northern capital of Sana'a by the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels in 2014, and its loss represented another humiliation. both the government and the STC are technically allies in the long war against the Iran-aligned Houthi rebels. The secessionists believe the South should be an independent state, as it was before forced unification in 1990. The deal set a timetable for the government's return to Aden, the appointment of a new head of security and a governor of the city, as well as the formation of a new 24-member cabinet with equal representation for Southerners. Well, Yemen's Prime Minister Ma'in Abdulmalik returned to the city, but the two sides have failed to meet the other deadlines, which were all to be in place within a month of the signing. Other parts of the agreement, including placing forces from both sides under the authority of the Defense and Interior Ministries by January 5, have also not been fulfilled. Well, the agreement had an extremely ambitious timetable, said Faria El-Muslimi, an associate fellow at London's Chatham House think tank. As both sides look for an exit, they are trading accusations over who is responsible for the failure to enact the accord. The agreement has the same problem as any other Yemeni agreement. Everyone wants to sign and no one wants to implement, Muslimi had said. Well, for Elizabeth Kendall, the Yemen expert and senior research fellow at Oxford University in the United Kingdom, the lack of confidence between the two sides is responsible for the failure to implement the agreement in good faith. The main challenge is that both sides appear to have entered the agreement grudgingly at the behest of their sponsors, she said. They include Saudi Arabia, which supports the government, and the United Arab Emirates, which has trained STC forces, despite being part of the Saudi-led military coalition backing the government against the Houthi rebels. Well, other major challenges abound, including a total lack of trust between the two parties, impossible deadlines, and clashing interpretations, she said. The danger right now is that some kind of trigger event will lead to a renewed STC government conflict, said Peter Salisbury, an analyst at the International Crisis Group. Kendall said that security and stability in southern Yemen remains, quote, highly precarious, end quote. And clashes are ongoing in southern flashpoints as those loyal to the government, to the STC, and even to neither, all jockey for position, she said. With the situation on the ground in the south at stalemate, there is little hope left. Tens of thousands of people have been killed and millions driven to the brink of famine in Yemen's war, which erupted between the government and the Houthi rebels back in 2014, prompting a Saudi-led military intervention. Around 3.3 million people have been displaced, and about 20 million people, more than two-thirds of the population, need help to survive, according to the United Nations, which considers it the world's worst humanitarian crisis. Unbelievable. Unbelievable. Well, 1 second here. Want to move back here again because this is the latest report out of Lebanon. Lebanese demonstrators are taking to the streets in a show of ongoing protests. I think we've got this covered. I thought that we had an update. It's not the case. One second. This is very interesting about the United States, Japan, the European Union seeking new global rules limiting subsidies. Washington, Tokyo, and Brussels today joined forces in calling for stronger global rules against government subsidies that distort trade, a practice China has long been accused of exploiting. The governments called on the World Trade Organization to beef up existing regulations, which they said in a statement are, quote, insufficient to tackle market and trade distorting subsidization, end quote. But they refrained from naming China directly. U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer met on Tuesday with Japan's economy, trade, and industry minister Kajiyama Yoroshi and European Trade Commissioner Phil Hogan, and also discuss the need to prevent forced technology transfers, an issue at the heart of the U.S.-China trade conflict. These unfair practices are inconsistent with an international trading system based on market principles and undermine, quote, growth and development, end quote, the statement had said. Well, the latest statement came after many months of trilateral meetings, a rare display of multilateral cooperation by the administration of President Donald Trump, who has launched multi-front trade wars and crippled the World Trade Organization's dispute settlement function. Well, the three sides called on the World Trade Organization, the WTO, to ban government support that is unlimited or that is given to insolvent or ailing enterprises with no, quote, credible restructuring plan, end quote, companies that cannot get along, cannot get a long-term financing or investment on their own or for debt forgiveness. Sorry. He also calls for a ban on subsidies for industries that are over capacity. This is another issue behind longstanding complaints against China in industries like steel and aluminum, where the markets have been flooded with supply, driving down prices and pushing some firms out of business. The officials also want to make it easier for World Trade Organization members to file complaints against other harmful subsidies, including those supporting uncompetitive firms. Such subsidies can create massive manufacturing capacity, quote, without private commercial participation, end quote, or lower domestic input prices in comparison to the prices of the goods when they are export-bound, the statement had said. Definitely, these are major, major concerns, and we're going to have to see where all that goes. Now, just bear with me a moment here, which is interesting. One second. Here it is. We talked before about Nissan and Renault. Well, the German car makers have beaten global sales slump. Very, very interesting. German car giants Volkswagen, BMW, and Daimler have posted strong growth sales or sales growth in the face of a contracting global market in 2019, shifting massive numbers of SUVs ahead of a pivotal year for electric mobility. While ratings agency Fitch estimated global unit sales shrank 4% year on year, figures released in recent days show BMW gaining 2%, Mercedes-Benz 1.3%, and the 12-brand Volkswagen Group flagship brand 1.3%. But even with growing sales, carmakers plan over 40,000 job cuts in the coming years, with Opel the latest to announce 2,100 voluntary departures on Tuesday. Well, German manufacturers are well positioned with their premium brands, said Ferdinand Dudenhofer, the industry expert at the University of Duisburg Essen. In the fierce race to be worldwide number one in high-end cars, Daimler's nose remained ahead for the fourth year in a row. The Stuttgarters shipped a 2.34 million Mercedes-Benz, while Munich rose 2.17 million BMWs, both all-time records. Both premium manufacturers' figures were massively boosted by China, with Mercedes sales there growing 6.2% and BMW 13.1% year-on-year. But Volkswagen also highlighted strong performance in China, quote, thanks to the strength of its brand, end quote, Dudenhofer had said. More keenly touched by the U.S.-China trade conflict were American manufacturers like Ford and General Motors, he added. For all the German car makers, 2019 brought new strides for the dominance of SUVs in sales figures. Sales of BMW's X range grew 21%, now making up around half of total deliveries. At Daimler, one in three Mercedes sold was an SUV at almost 784,000 units, while Volkswagen Seat and Porsche subsidiaries also shipped more of the models. It's perfectly clear the SUVs drive sales and profits for the car maker, said Stefan Batzel of the Center of Automotive Management. But demand for the high margin gas guzzlers will squeeze manufacturers as they create and scramble to reduce carbon dioxide emissions in response to new European Union rules. From this year, automakers must reach an average of carbon dioxide emissions across their new vehicle fleets of below 95 grams per kilogram on pain of harsh fines from 2021. Electric cars have to hit the roads, otherwise the fines will land and they will be painful, Dudenhofer had said. Well, looking to reduce their climate impact, manufacturers have dozens of electric and hybrid models lined up for release in the coming years. In particular focus is Volkswagen's ID.3, a compact car presented to great fanfare at last year, September's IAA trade show, as the electric counterpart to the company's stalwart Golf. Meanwhile, BMW and Daimler are placing most of their chips on hybrids rather than all electric power. The manufacturers can't leave SUVs by the wayside, Bratzel said. Rather, they'll try to give them a coat of green paint to overcome their negative image. With many drivers still reluctant to take the electric plunge, demand will depend on the long term on charging infrastructure to reassure the doubters. Charging points also represent one factor for carmaker success, not completely under their control, Bratzel pointed out, but they are fundamental to plans, like Volkswagen's aim of selling 26 million electric vehicles and 6 million hybrids by 2029. Even if the targets are met, far fewer workers are needed to assemble an electric than an internal combustion engine, and cash is needed for research and development spending. And that points to, quote, a second major challenge on the jobs front for the pillar of German industry, Dudenhofer had warned. Very, very compelling story, something that of always interests our listeners, of course, because we have a radio broadcast show on Thursdays at 10 o'clock in the morning, where our driving me crazy duo, John and Lori Wiles, review what's on the automotive scene. Now, this is a new question, and this is a report from France 24. The question is, what is the Iranian government's strategy going forward? And this is a report by Reza Saya, who is France 24's reporter, who explains the Iranian government's recent movements and its strategy going forward. So listen in, and then we'll be able to hear this. Bear with me a moment. Okay. One second. So this is going to start in a moment. There we go.
The objective for the Iranian government is to do as much damage control as possible to perhaps redeem themselves, not just in the eyes of the international community, but perhaps more importantly, here at home, where many outraged Iranians have been protesting for the past 3 days in reaction to the downing of the Ukrainian airliner. Obviously, Iran made a catastrophic mistake in the early hours of last Wednesday morning when they shot down this Ukrainian airliner. What made things worse is that the Iranian leadership did not acknowledge that they had shot this plane down for 3 days. They say they needed that time to find out exactly what happened, and then they came out and announced it on Friday. But to many critics of the Iranian government leadership, that was not enough, with experts saying that the people will be held accountable and they will be punished. The judiciary also making an announcement that a number of people have been detained in connection with the downing of the airliner. Not clear who these individuals are and how they were connected, if they were, to the downing of this airliner. So all of this, again, an effort by the Iranian government to say to the international community and people here at home that we did this, we're accountable, we're going to get to the bottom of this. How will that play out in the international community and here at home? We'll see in the coming days.
Okay. Now, let's just check and see what else is happening on the stage as well. One second. All right, just need to move on. Bear with me a moment here. Okay. This is interesting, too, because the world is in an uproar, but here there's thousands of Tunisians evidently celebrated the anniversary of the revolution. It seems that thousands gathered in the heart of Tunisia's capital on Tuesday to celebrate the 9th anniversary of the popular revolution that deposed dictator Zine El Abidine Ben Ali. On a flag-filled Habib Bourguiba Avenue, parents, children, men and women of all ages marched in a festive atmosphere and gathered around musical groups. Some held signs aloft, including, "A people that managed to get rid of the dictatorship is capable of creating a better future," and, quote, "impossible is not Tunisian," end quote. I came with my children to relive the events of an important day in Tunisian history, 44-year-old Mohamed Mahed told Agence France-Presse. Despite the political situation, we are proud of our revolution. A heavy security presence was deployed along Bourguiba Avenue. Close by, several hundred people gathered in front of the headquarters of the UGTT Union Confederation, shouting, "Work, freedom, dignity," the revolution's main slogan. Addressing the crowd, Nourdine Taboubi, Secretary General of the powerful Confederation, denounced a political class that he had said wanted to divide Tunisians. 9 years have passed and the political scene has gone rotten, with politicians who are more interested in power than the interests of the country, Taboubi had said. Well, the deterioration of the situation, he added, has made the Tunisian state weak, without prestige, and incapable of enforcing the law. Quote, "We will not allow political amateurs to spread despair. The revolution will go on until the real republic has been established," he vowed. Well, the anniversary celebration took place against a tense political backdrop after Tunisia's parliament last Friday rejected a government put forward by the Islamist-inspired Ennahda party. Ennahda emerged from October legislative elections with more seats than any other party, but was still far short of a majority. It now falls on President Kais Saied, a fiercely independent academic with no background in politics, who won a second round presidential runoff in October, to designate a prime minister capable of winning lawmakers' confidence. If Saied's chosen candidate fails to form a government, the legislature would be dissolved. Woo. Very, very much a foreboding situation. Wow. What horror. You know, people live through unbelievable, concern and strife and unbelievable fear, and one government after the other. It seems that very few nations have figured out how really to manage rather than control, or even listen to the responses or the needs of a particular particular people. The population that they're supposed to represent. Evidently, that's not seemingly an interesting thing for a lot of places. Well, let me just quickly go back to our studio screen, but I think we're fine. It's time for us to go, and we hope that you'll consider joining us tomorrow. And that's where we'll be. So we'll catch you tomorrow with Dr. Oren M. Levin-Wolfman, who is away And so he's back. I think he came back on Monday, so he'll be able to join us tomorrow. So all the best to everyone, and thanks for being with us today. What a pleasure. Goodbye.